You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston and we are recording this episode on a Friday morning after a fantastic, enthralling, and a bit chaotic game of football at Molineux Stadium on Thursday night between Wolves and Manchester United. But fortunately, United came out on top and won 4-3 in the end after a late goal from the brilliant Kobbie Mainoo. Samuel Lucas was at the game. We'll get in this episode. We're going to dissect the performance, get into it, discuss whether Mainoo is the best player in the world, look at the Rashford decision to start him because that was quite significant, look at Ten Hag's changes, etc. And then look ahead to West Ham because United are back in action on Sunday again in the Premier League. But first of all, Samuel, how are you? Because you must have got back to your house a little bit late last night.
Nearly 2 a.m. but feeling very well this morning. It does make a big difference when United win, as we all know, covering them from a journalistic perspective. I'm just longing for the day where they actually go 3-0 up in a game, because I think if they do that, then they might win comfortably. Last night for 70 odd minutes it was going according to plan, and then chaos ensued, and those last, what I suppose it was, 27 minutes, given the added time, probably pushing half an hour. So it was, I didn't expect the magnificent spread at Molineux to be topped by the actual game itself, because we know what drudgery it can be, Wolves United at Molineux, but last night was one of the games of the season in the end, I suppose.
It's usually like a 0-0 or a 1-0 or a 1-1. It's usually pretty drab, isn't it? But last night was fantastic. I mean, what a game, what a spectacle. We'll start off with the dominant performance then, Samuel, because the first half really was fantastic. It was probably the best first half performance of the season. I think it's fair to say United should have been out of sight by the time it was half time. It could have been 3 or 4-0. There were multiple chances wasted toward the end of that first half. And I suppose on a night like that, that's the only criticism, really. United should have been more clinical and should have buried a few more chances, but it was a really, really promising display.
It felt more like the United of last season. There was a lot going for it, and coming away from the stadium, there is a sense of, you know, the mood is far more upbeat now. Of course it's going to be after a win like that, but they've won games late on earlier in the season where you've come away from the ground, you thought, well, that's probably papered over the cracks. I mean, Brentford was an extraordinary finale with two goals in added time, and Fulham, they got one late right at the death there as well. But they still weren't the inspiring wins that they should have been. I thought last night that was a captivating performance from United for at least 45 minutes. Ten Hag thought an hour. Even before they got the goal in the fifth minute, there was a slickness to them, there was an incision. And really, it was the way just Ten Hag conducted himself, even extended to the press conference afterwards when he said he had mixed feelings about the win because they didn't win handsomely. I thought, well, this is more like the United of last season, in that they would win well. There was a lot for the fans to get invested in, a lot to revel in that the manager was still quite critical of elements of the performance in victory. We've not heard that so much from Ten Hag this season, but he was last night at his post-match press conference. And they should have been out of sight. That was the one issue. They had, I mean, Fernandes and Casemiro had great chances, I think, at 2-0 in the first half. They, of course, had two disallowed goals. There was one chance early on in the second half that was for Fernandes again, where uncharacteristically for him, he just wasn't particularly clinical. And I thought he actually played well last night. The finishing was the only thing that let him down. And I thought Casemiro played very well last night, apart from two fouls that obviously had a big bearing on his performance and the decision to substitute him with the penalty decision. I thought when I first saw it that wasn't going to get overturned just because there wasn't a replay that could prove there was next to no contact on the Wolves player. I mean, he absolutely made a meal of it. Van Dijk on Nkunku the night before was much more of a penalty, and this is why people get... why VAR drives people mad. It's the inconsistency.
It wasn't a penalty, was it, Samuel? I know the game's... it's a cliche, the game's gone a long time ago, but that was just so soft. He almost freeze on his ankle. There was minimal contact there.
I thought even the reaction of the United players was telling, and they know VAR exists, and that, yet Casemiro still reacted with the confidence that shouldn't be a penalty, knowing that it was going to be checked by some robot at Stockley Park. But it's the way it works, just, as I said, it drives me up the wall. The night before, you've got Paul Tierney refereeing at Anfield, and of course, because Liverpool fans can be quite a paranoid bunch, and they think Paul Tierney is anti-Liverpool. When he doesn't give a penalty, you almost wonder, is the guy who's on VAR, is he thinking, you know what, they're 3-1 up, they're pasting Chelsea here. If I have to make him go over to the monitor and then he has to point to the spot, then he's going to cop more flat like he could do without it. It's the precedent set by that clown Mike Dean with Anthony Taylor over the hair pulling for Harry Kane's equaliser at Chelsea last season. So that was a slice of luck that went Wolves' way, but in credit to United, it's in-game management from Ten Hag, where McTominay comes on. We know that he's got a goal in him. He gets that goal. But the game management after that, I'm sure we'll get into the equalising goal. It felt, when that went in, if you're a United fan, it must have felt like a defeat, or it felt like it was going to be a defeat rather than a draw, because they'd thrown it away. Then we just see and the horrible truth of this is, with that magnificent winning goal, is that because of the chaos that ensued after Pedro Neto's equaliser, I didn't see it. I just saw a ball bouncing in the net, and then I saw Kobbie Mainoo heading towards the away end and Diogo Dalot charging towards the away end. I thought, well, they've won it. And that's the dilemma you have, especially when you're filing a piece. And as I said, for 70 minutes, it's great. United have been brilliant, just pure positivity, easy win. That's what we want. And then, of course, a spanner is thrown into the works, and then the works just, you know, fall apart, and you don't know how to make head or tail of it. But if it would have ended 3-3, it would have been, of course, a negative angle, because United had at that point, it looked like they'd thrown it away. But the goal just, I mean, I've watched it back a few times, almost out of shame that I had my head buried in my bloody laptop. But it's just the audacity to shimmy past one, nutmeg one, go around the other. And one of the things that was probably overlooked at the time is that when he veers inside Mainoo and the shot is there, you've got Fernandes, who's almost out of shot, but he's probably the furthest player away. And he's almost ordering him to play it to someone else. He's thinking, you've done the hard work, now give it to someone else to have a go at a goal. And then, of course, he goes for a goal himself. And a lot of players in that situation, whether they're professional or amateur or five-a-side players, they probably would have just wellied it there. I know I'm dreadful at shooting. I'd have just probably hit it badly and it would have gone straight at the goalkeeper. But he has the confidence and the poise and the elegance to make sure that he arches that ball well out of Jose Sarr's reach, and it goes into not even the corner of the net, it went into the side of the net. That's how far away it was, away from Sarr's palm. We've rhapsodized about Kobbie Mainoo in so many podcasts, and hopefully for United's sake, we will continue to do so for many more podcasts to come, because as I said before, he is the long-term linchpin in that team. He's just brilliant to watch, and he was brilliant again last night.
At halftime, I was thinking, who is this team and what have they done with Manchester United? And then 20 minutes later, I go, oh God, here we go. I mean, it was obviously not a penalty, but I think almost a Wolves equaliser felt inevitable at that point when I was watching the game. I actually messaged Liam Corliss, formerly of this church, of this parish, and said, look, I just think Wolves are going to score. Did eventually, 3-3. And I was the same as you, Samuel. Although I was working from home and obviously doing the live blog, I only looked up when Mina was about to hit the ball. So I didn't actually see his shimmy and beating a few men. It's only this morning and last night when I've kind of watched the clip back and I thought, what a goal that is. It was really, really brilliant. And he is a fantastic player. You've said it yourself there. We've been on this podcast a lot of times now, praising Mainu. But we saw him in pre-season. He was fantastic. He was the breakout star. Kind of hoped he would break into the team this year. Obviously, an injury delayed that. Unfortunately, he picked up an ankle injury. But since coming back to fitness, he's been really, really brilliant. And I almost question now, with Mason Mount sidelined with injury, where's he going to fit back into this team? I mean, that's been the question.
No, he doesn't.
For the last 6 months, but because of me and his prominence and because of the way he's playing, I think that question becomes even bigger now.
I don't think we're getting carried away when we say that when it comes to the summer, and it's pretty clear that United will need a midfielder of some profile to come into the squad, it's got to be someone who is going to complement Mainu, because the way it's going now, it's who starts, and it's not been just now, it's been the case for 2 months, it's who starts with Kobbie Mainoo. It's not if Kobbie Mainoo starts. And we all suspected that Casemiro would be the ideal foil for him. And it's not a coincidence that Casemiro has come into the team and Mainoo has gone from a guard to a goal getter. He scored 2 goals in 2 games with Casemiro alongside him. And they complement each other really well. And it was interesting what Ten Hag said to me last night when I asked him about when he first saw Kobbie Mainoo, when he first, you know, caught his eye. And Ten Hag said he felt he was too comfortable in the under-21s, that he wasn't dominating enough. And I thought it was really interesting insight, because you look at Mainoo's development and it's just gone so naturally. It's the blueprint for any budding academy player at United if they want to graduate and get into the first team. But when he came out with that little revelation that he was too comfortable in the under-21s, it was almost as if he looked at that level and thought, he's too good for this level already. We need to get him playing with men here and players who've got more experience and are playing at a more intense level. And
I think that's what a lot of us saw, not just Ten Hag, when we watched him in the academy. You could tell a lot of it came effortlessly to him. His range of passing, how composed he was. He did look a cut above. And what I've been surprised at, though, because you can watch a player and you can predict that he's going to transition to the first team and have success, how easy he's made it look. It's been just unbelievable. I think he deserves so much praise for that, because it's not a guarantee stepping up from academy football to the Premier League. It's a different beast.
Oh, it is. And you just go back to, I mean, it was quite reassuring when I looked up what was the first thing I ever wrote about Mainoo watching him at a game. And I think it was Kobbie Mainoo in midfield was exceptional. So my judgment isn't too bad. It's reassuring to know, going back to that FA Youth Cup semi-final from 2 years ago nearly. I think it was Wolves they beat. But I was just struck by him.
I was going to say, ironically, against Wolves as well.
Yes, yeah. Oh, coincidentally, yes, indeed. I didn't even mention that in the piece, so I could have enhanced my piece a little bit more this morning. But even then, he stood out because he was a modern midfielder. And I remember a friend who went to a reserves friendly that summer, and he said how different Mainoo looked. He'd bulked up. And already, he'd only just turned 17 at that point. I think he'd have turned 17 in April 22. You think, okay, he means business here. And of course, he was selected in the matchday squad against Newcastle at home last season. That was Ten Hag's 13th game in charge. He went on the training camp to Cadiz. And there wasn't a lot to write home about from the games, other than, in my opinion, Mainoo. And I did a piece on him at the time saying that he was nearing his next breakthrough at United. So I was particularly delighted when in the January, less than probably around a month later, he did make his debut against Charlton. And he would have probably been more involved, a little bit more involved last season, had he not got injured in early April. And that was him done for the season, unfortunately. He was looking really, really good in pre-season, and it was such a shame that he was the collateral damage in that tackle by Casemiro on on Rodrigo in the friendly against Real Madrid in Houston back in July. And although we had to wait 4 months for him to come into the team, and of course you saw him at Salford, I think it was, and I remember tweeting you, he shouldn't be at Salford tonight. He should be with the first team tomorrow night. Oh, did I?
I don't
even see any of this stick that comes my way because, I don't mind saying it, but I'm clearly going to be a better judge than people hiding behind pseudonyms and avatars on Twitter. But, I think we put the hard yards in. We watch these players from a young age and we do know what we're talking about. And I've never had a shred of doubt with Maynou that he's a player that could, if he hadn't have got injured in July, then United would probably be higher up in the Premier League table and they'd be having a better season. He's only got 15 games under his belt still, which is still, it's a very lowly number, but you only have to look back to that infamous substitution against Nottingham Forest in late December when he came off at half-time at 0-0 and then United lost 2-1 and both goals, there was a void in midfield for them. He started in all four games since, and Ten Hag has not taken him off in any of them. And that's the telling, that's the latest telling development in Maynou's.
You think of the tests that he's passed as well, Samuel, with flying colours, the games, Goodison Park away, Galatasaray, even St. James's Park.
Anfield.
You look at those three games that were billed. Yeah, exactly. Anfield as well. I mean, those four games were billed as huge atmospheres that were going to be intimidating, that were going to be challenging. And Maynou was just himself again. He excelled, he looked comfortable. At ease on the ball, and that's just so impressive at home.
Yeah, and even when he made an error against West Ham and it led to Mohamed Kudus scoring, his performance that day will be more remembered for how accomplished he looked in the 77 minutes before that miscontrol. And you saw that the anguish etched on his face as it dawned on him that his error had led to West Ham effectively boxing the game off and winning it. He clearly cares. He's a local lad. He's almost the representative for the fans on the pitch, is the way I see it, given that he has come through the academy, he was born in Stockport, he's won the FA Youth Cup. United fans love nothing more than to see a local lad come into the team and make a name for himself, as Marcus Rashford did 8 years ago, so unforgettably against Midtjylland and then Arsenal a few days later. And Garnacho did it last season. And look, one of the biggest pros about Ten Hag is his development of youngsters. De Ligt and De Jong at Ajax, and now Garnacho and Maynou at United. And that is integral criteria for a Manchester United manager. And he's done a phenomenal job with both of those players so far. And both of those players, they're starters for United. And nobody would entertain the prospect of dropping either of them.
I've told everyone who would listen for a while now that Kobbie Mainoo was going straight to the top. I was having a coffee there from a flatmate before starting this morning, Samuel, who's a diehard Manchester United fan. And I was saying, remember 18 months ago, 2 years ago, when I was at those academy games telling you how good this lad was? And he was like, yep. And he's a massive fan now. I think the next thing United fans need to do, though, Samuel, is create a chant for Kobbie Mainoo.
I saw that last night.
No doubt that will come pretty soon. Yeah, no doubt that will come pretty soon. There was a chant for Marcus Rashford. Do you want to tell listeners who mightn't have heard it what it was?
I don't know if we can swear on this. Do we beep it out? I don't know. But it was very witty. It was Rashford's on the piss, on the piss. Rashford's on the piss. Yeah, which I thought was it was classic. It was a classic United away end song, and the away end is not ideal at Wolves because it stretches across the whole of the Steve Ball stand. So a chant that starts at one end can, start at the other end about 2 minutes later. It's difficult to really generate an atmosphere when you're spread so far across one stand. But that was the one that certainly the noise carried very, very easily with that. There were a couple of, we were in the far row of the press box. And so there was some very sound Wolves fans. In fact, going to Molyneux is great anyway, but the company of the Wolves fans is always pretty good. Speaking to one almost on and off a few years ago, but the two behind us last night were amused by it. And what I also appreciated with the two Wolves fans as well was just how insulted they were by by Anthony and how bad he was. And I'm thinking, like, this, you know, this guy could do you a favor. And of course, what happened was that he did them a massive favor by turning attack into defense and allowing them to equalize at the end.
We'll stick with Rashford for the time being then, Samuel. I wanted to get into him a bit because it was a huge decision to start him, a massive one. Maybe not surprising because of the way Ten Hag actually spoke about him at the press conference. He kind of discussed his blossoming connection with Rasmus Højlund, and then in his pre-match interview with MUTV, he mentioned that as well. And lo and behold, for Rashford's goal, Højlund plays it off, Rashford tucks it in, and all is forgiven. All is forgotten, Samuel. You can go to Belfast, get drunk, come score a goal. Doesn't matter.
It was just the ticket for him and for United. It nipped it in the bud so quickly. And what was particularly noticeable at kickoff was that when the teams came out, it occurred to us that given that Wolves preferred to attack the Sir Jack Haywood stand in the second half, the likelihood was that Rashford was going to be playing in front of the away end in the first half. So if he'd started a bit ropily, they might have got on his back. But when he came out for his warm-up, he held his arms aloft, he said a little prayer, he sauntered towards a loose ball and embarked on a dribble, but there were hardly any fans in the stands, so it was impossible to make out whatever reception that he got from any of them. There was no point writing home anything about it. When he came out for the game, he ran towards them, and some offered applause. This was just before kickoff. Rashford didn't clap them, which, you know, you can read into that what you will, but I'm just relaying what I saw there. But the goal was a terrific goal, and as soon as he hit it, you knew it was going in. It's probably the purest he's struck a football all season. And one of the criticisms that there's been of Rashford throughout his career is that he can only have one shooting technique. It's always on the laces. There's a lack of finesse about it. That wasn't the case last season. And it wasn't just scoring goals. It was the way he created goals. He'd go on the outside sometimes. He wouldn't always cut inside. He was a cleverer footballer last season. And there was a variety about his goals. He scored some really good headed goals. He would take up good positions. I remember against Palace at home, he started the game on the left. He moved inside in the second half. And that's where he scored the winning goal from a centre forwards position. We've not seen much of that at all this season. That's one of the reasons why before last night he's only got four goals. But as I said, the pureness of the strike was terrific, and like, you know, he could have cracked into a smile. I know he's smiling at the end of the game, and I think it was at Casemiro's behest when he gave him a playful slap on the head that he did break into a smile. And look, there was a lot to smile about. It was a terrific goal. It was his highlight of the season. And you know, history repeats itself, because of course he going into the game at Wolves last season, he was the one who was talked about because he had been dropped as a disciplinary matter. Slightly different circumstances last night in that he started the game. And fair play to Ten Hag. As I said earlier, I thought last night was one of those games where he had the Midas touch again, because a lot of United fans would not have had a lot of United fans, a lot of United punters wouldn't have had Rashford starting out the principal.
I don't think any of us selected him in our panel teams, did we?
No, well, I didn't. And, you know, I'm sure we all look a bit daft for putting Anthony in after the way he played when he came on last night. But it's admirable of Ten Hag, because he saw that game as, look, I've got my strongest players available for the first time in my 94th game in charge. I'm going to maximise this against a team that are unbeaten at home since September, are unbeaten in their last seven games. I've got to play my strongest team. And look, it was completely vindicated, because United had their best half of the season and Rashford scored a terrific goal.
A big decision, and it certainly paid off. Obviously, another academy graduate on the score sheet, Scott McTominay, who made an almost immediate impact from off the bench with that. It was a bit of a scruffy goal, but he won't mind. It's now his seventh in all competitions this season, so he's having a phenomenal year, despite almost being close to leaving the club. And I'll give a mention to Mari Forsten as well, actually, for Kobbie Mainoo's winning goal, because he had the awareness to lay it off. That could have went wrong, and he could have been dispossessed or made the wrong pass, but he picked the right one, and United claimed the 3 points. We'll leave it there for the part one, Samuel, and we'll be back in a moment for part two. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester is Red podcast. Now, Samuel, you kind of alluded to it there at the end of the first part, but Ten Hag's changes, his team selection really paid off last night. As you said, it was his strongest team. Fair to say the strongest team that he's picked yet throughout his tenure, yeah. I think. And it was a huge decision to start Rashford, but those players responded, they really delivered. And we've talked on this podcast over the last few months about the injuries and how much they've affected the team. And I know we've kind of played that down to some extent. But we wondered what the team would perform like when those players were back on the pitch, and we got an answer last night.
And I think that was why he had mixed feelings, as those were his words, about the win, in that it would have been immense vindication for him had United gone out there and just taken Wolves to the cleaners, as they should have done with his strongest ever 11. And yeah, his proclamation on how they would be a different side with those players coming back was slightly undermined, because they did commit errors that they have been committing all season. I mean, there were shades of the Galatasaray 3-0 in the second half, the way they just folded with Kilman's goal and then Neto's equaliser. Getting done on the counter-attack in the 95th minute as well was borderline unforgivable. But I think when Ten Hag has gone on about the injuries, the reason why we've kind of given it short shrift is that every club, it feels like, in the Premier League this season, they've had quite a lot of injuries to contend with at one point or another. City have been without Kevin De Bruyne for a long time. They've been without Erling Haaland for a long time. Tottenham had a pretty depleted front six at Old Trafford last month. But those clubs and those teams, they have coped with the injury toll better than United have. And so that's
the Tottenham
why
the result, I know it was only a draw and it almost felt like a defeat when we were talking about it, but that was really jarring for me, because Spurs still had the style of play, still went around the business exactly in the same manner, and they dominated the game. They should have probably left with the 3 points with a depleted side.
Yeah, and I've not really looked at, there haven't been too many games this season where I've looked at United's team and I thought, yeah, they should be getting beaten today. Liverpool away was an occasion going into it, excuse me, where a lot of people, myself included, were wondering how many are Liverpool going to win by, and United ended up drawing that game. So although they have had a lot of injuries this season, and it's I think it's pushing, given the latest one with Wan-Bissaka, it's probably pushing like 40 separate cases of injury or illness. Which is an extraordinary amount when we've just come into February. But they've not coped well enough with it, and they have had the coping mechanisms. There's a reason why you assemble a squad of between 25 and 30 players, and almost all of them are internationals. You need that quality and depth. And that's why I think a lot of us have given United short shrift. And other teams, as you said, the prime example, a pertinent one, given that they were the last opponents at Old Trafford and Tottenham, is that they played in a recognisable way. You could see what they were trying to do. You watched Tottenham the other night as well, where Son Heung-min is still not in the starting lineup, and Oliver Skip is still starting for them as well, and Højbjerg is playing a more prominent role than he was when Bissouma and Sarr were available. They play their... They are identifiable in the way they play. The Postecoglou's fingerprints all over that team already. Last night, that was, I think Ten Hag had said it before. I remember asking him about it in Istanbul after the Galatasaray draw. And there are elements, there were glimpses at that time where you thought, okay, I can recognise what he's trying to do with the team and what he wants the players to do and the way they're executing it. The problem that night was that it was undermined by the goalkeeper chucking a couple in. And let's face it, he was culpable again last night. I'm sure we'll get onto him in a little bit. But one of the reasons why they didn't win handsomely last night was because they have a goalkeeper who lets savable shots or attempts go in. And there were two more yesterday evening from Andre Onana. So as I said at the start of the podcast, I'm yearning for the day that United go 3-0 up in a game, because at that point I'd probably be confident that I'm not going to have to alter my match piece before full time. But they're just the team that can't go without drama this season, and they've got a few more goals in the Premier League now because the goal difference column was, it's still not great. I think they're probably still in the minus numbers, aren't they? but the goals for column, there are four more added to it. And that was, I think that was the first time they'd scored four in the league under Ten Hag last night as well. And they should have done that probably in the first half alone. And it's given how good they were in that first half last night and how in control they were for 60 or 70 minutes, there's a lot to build on. And also, as good as they were as a collective, there were some really, really good individual performances. Certainly at 2-0, I think it was going to be almost 8 out of 10s in the player ratings. But the last half an hour, it brought quite a few players' marks down.
I think that's what was so encouraging as well about that first half performance. As you said, there was actually a structure. I mean, yeah, we've looked at games this season and analysed them. We thought, what are they trying to do? It seemed like there was an actual plan and it was working. I think the midfield was key to that. Manu, Casemiro, Fernandes clearly complement each other very well. Casemiro was kind of dropping back when Wolves had possession and pushing forward. That helped out the defence a lot. And Wolves were really struggling to create anything in that first half. They didn't really give Onana anything to do. That did change after half time. We'll get into that equaliser then, Samuel, with Anthony, because game management, it's always been a bit of a doubt of this team. It's always been a bit of a criticism. We have questioned quite often the game management of this team and Ten Hag's decisions as well. But you can't really blame Ten Hag for this one. Anthony had the ball, he overplayed, he lost it. Wolves broke up the other side of the pitch. Even then, there were still two players that could have dealt with it, mind. Varane, I think it was Dalot as well. I'll have to watch it back, but I think it was them too.
I mean, obviously, Varane it was a great finish in the end,
but it really shouldn't have happened. Yeah, I mean, it should have been stopped at its source, and the ball shouldn't have broke forward, really. And Anthony, taken to the corner, retain possession. When it's so late in the game, you've got to be a bit more intelligent than that.
I think the only good thing Anthony did, and it was in front of the United fans as well, so that would have helped him, was that I think he put a tackle in and won the ball back. Other than that, every time he got the ball, he was a liability. And I did think at the time when Rashford came off that Garnacho was quite weak last night. He kept on going, but his end product wasn't there. And I thought the winger to take off would have been Garnacho. Of course, Rashford hadn't had a game for nearly 3 weeks and also had a night on the tiles in Belfast last week as well. So I'm sure Garnacho was fresher, but I'd probably rather have an intoxicated Marcus Rashford on a football pitch than Anthony now. It's borderline unforgivable what he did with the ball there. And Omari Forson is 18 and has got, what, three cameo appearances to his name now in the United first team.
He's got more Premier League assists than Anthony this season.
He's got up to speed in the Premier League quicker than Anthony has in 18 months already. I'm fed up of really talking about him in a way, in that when he scored and had an assist at the weekend, it was almost like, well, who cares really? I mean, look, you've if anything, he's possibly found his level against a League Two side, but nobody was coming away from that or filing a colour piece on this is Anthony's turning point in a Manchester United shirt. And the fact that he was actually dropped last night, having scored his first goal of the season and claimed his first assist of the season as well, and that he's Ten Hag's man, having come in for 86.3 million from Ajax, was also telling, because that shows you that Ten Hag clearly has doubts about him. He does not see him as a starter anymore.
Samuel, it's taken long enough though, because his kind of continued selection of him was baffling and indefensible at times. He's finally now, in the last few months, kind of dropped him to the bench and perhaps, dare I say, it's seen what we've all been watching.
Yeah, well, he was dropped, would it have been in November, I think? I mean, he got some stick against Fulham when he came off.
Galatasaray performance was actually pretty good away from home in the Champions League.
I think in terms of the mid-season player ratings of the season, I think he was bumped up from a 1 to a 2 just because he played well against Galatasaray, and then he played well against...
That's very generous of you.
Yes, and then he played well against Chelsea the following week, but he definitely came out of the team after the Fulham game for a good period. Then he was put back in the team against Galatasaray to everyone's surprise and did well. And then he was strangely dropped for Newcastle away, which of course was the infamous Rashford and Martial disaster
pass. That felt unfair at the time. I think he should have started that game. He should have,
Match. Then he came back into the team against Chelsea, did well. He has he has since regressed. He's failed to kick on, and I don't think anybody is remotely surprised by that either. He's just, there's very little, he's just not got much about him. And we've watched him for the best part of 18 months now, as I said, and he's a write-off. Whether you're Ten Hag or whether you're another Manchester United manager coming in later on in the year, they're going to need two forwards in the summer anyway, just because of the wingers that they need to get out of the club, and also the lack of goals that there have been this season. And I think realistically, there is not going to be a taker for Antony. They're going to be dependent, I think, on a Saudi Pro League side giving them money to take him off their hands, if indeed he'd be receptive to that. But you can't.
Do you not think it's absolutely bonkers that here we are again on a podcast in February 2024 talking about the need perhaps to sign another right winger? I mean, you've had Ahmed, Pelestri, Sancho, Antony, all signed for over 200 million combined. And potentially this summer we could go in and say perhaps someone like Michael Olise for another 50 million, but the spend on that area has been immense. It's just not worked out.
Oh, well, it goes back further than that. It goes back to Wilfred Zaha in 2013. Mkhitaryan was seen as the solution for that side, even though he saw himself as a playmaker. Of course, you know, the one who they didn't pay any money for was Mason Greenwood, who looked like he was going to have a long term future at United, and that is not the case. And hopefully, that will also remain no longer. Hopefully that is also still not the case under Ineos as well. But again, as you said, I mean, Elise and Eze, the only bright sparks at Crystal Palace. They're the only players there making them watchable. But you could see that you just hope if they do go down that line that they get the right character in, because we've seen before, and I thought that with Antony as well. I thought you could talk about character, and yes, he's got a spiky side to him, but that doesn't mean that you've got the right character to hack it at Manchester United. And as I said, he was a liability last night. When you bring McTominay on, okay, there's not a lot of technical ability there, but he'll put himself about, he will muck in, he's good for a goal. There's merit to having him on the bench, and there's merit to bringing him on in certain circumstances as well. When I saw that Antony was coming on with him, I was a little bit worried for United at that point, because I just thought, it's like that quote in The Sopranos season two where Tony's telling Robert Patrick's character, who's a gambling addict, and he says, "This game's not for you." I keep feeling that with Antony, like, this game's not for you. West Ham on Sunday, that game's not for you. Villa away next week, that game's not for you. Even Luton away, that is also not for you. A game for you might be Ajax against Go Ahead Eagles. That's probably a game. That's probably one that he would do well in.
What are you going to do, Anthony? What are you going to do? That was my Tony Soprano impression, Samuel. But I imagine you can do very better good than that. From one Brazilian to another, we mentioned how good Casemiro was. He's probably a bit off the pace against Newport, which wasn't a good omen, especially coming back from injury. Considering he was so fantastic last season, and the first few months of this season he was very poor, so we're hoping to see him back to his best now. But that performance last night was the first step to that. He looks like the Casemiro that we know from last season. He was fantastic, disrupting play, winning the ball, playing it forward, distributing it and protecting the back four. So it was really, really encouraging to see Casemiro perform like that, wasn't it?
It was, and Ten Hag said afterwards in his embargo bit, I mean, this podcast will go out after the embargo anyway, that he does need games to find his rhythm and hit his stride. And he did need that last season as well. It's easy to forget that he was eased in. I don't think he made his Premier League debut until almost 6 weeks into his United career, because, of course, he was signed on the night of
Scott McTominay
the Liverpool
was picked
game.
Over him a lot of times,
yeah,
wasn't he? And we
that's
kept on
right.
scratching our heads.
That's right. And it was only after they conceded six at City that he came into the team, and he did quite well in his first league start at Everton the next week. He made a mistake in that game. He got robbed of the ball, and Alex Iwobi ended up scoring the goal. But then he ended the half robbing Iwobi of the ball and setting Cristiano Ronaldo away to score the winning goal. And I remember that night, most of the players went to Casemiro first rather than Ronaldo, which you can imagine what Ronaldo would have made of that. But that was a reflection of, you know, the high esteem he's held in, and also how well he did in that moment to have that impact in a half which had started quite badly for him. But as you said, last night he had a very bad start with the yellow card in the third minute, and it was a definite yellow as well. I mean, Ten Hag was protesting it with the fourth official. I thought, you're wasting your time here. It was, I don't know why he's got it in him, Casemiro, but he does have it in him to commit these needlessly crude tackles that are completely avoidable. And that kind of tackle he made in the third minute, it's one that you'd rather make in the 70th minute if you're hanging on to a win and you want to just scupper a breakaway or halt an attack by any means necessary. But he was serenaded on at least two occasions by the United supporters in the first half. His reading of the game was good. As I said earlier, he clearly complements Mainoo very, very well. It's a good developing partnership they've got going on there. And when he came off, he had a few words with Ten Hag, and I wondered whether he was complaining about the penalty decision or complaining at being substituted. But at that time, you knew that it was sensible to bring him off, given that he'd been on a yellow card for 70-odd minutes, and he had committed about three other fouls, I think. None of them, I'd say, were worthy of a booking, but if he did commit another foul, it might have been a matter of accumulation, then he'd have possibly been sent off, and he's been sent off three times in his United career. But when he was replaced by McTominay, and when McTominay scored, Casemiro was quick to hug Ten Hag. So for all his faults this season in terms of his performance level between August and October, and of course he was substituted in his before last night, his previous league start was against Brentford, and he was hooked at half time. He was dreadful in that half. But his attitude is spot on. You're not going to have a problem with his attitude. You might have a problem with him being overexposed at times or not. Not his fitness taking a while to get up to speed. But look, last night that was the Casemiro of last season, I thought.
He loves the yellow card. He was booked against Newport as well. I thought that, but I was just double checking. So two appearances.
Yeah, bad foul against Newport as well.
Yeah, he loves a clumsy challenge, doesn't he? It's like mere five aside, ironically. That in terms of what the win actually meant, Samuel, up to seventh in the league. Excellent. On 35 points, 8 points off Tottenham in fourth. We've played down the chances of getting Champions League all season, but I mean, when you look at the table, it's not beyond the realms of possibility at all. If the mount is strong end to the season, I mean, Martinez and Casemiro are so key to this team. We've seen that since they've came back. It is possible. Obviously, it will depend on how Tottenham perform and Spurs are Spurs. But United have got a chance.
Yeah, I don't think we've played it down all season. At the start of the season, we were talking Ten Hag has got everything he wants in the transfer window.
I think I was playing it down United since have got to kick the end on. Of September, I would say.
That would be fair, definitely, given that, you know, given the way that month ended with a defeat to Crystal Palace, I think at that point they'd have lost four games in the Premier League already. I think it would have been, and they've lost a fair few since. I mean, the competitiveness in the league this season is probably the most intense, certainly in my lifetime. There don't seem to be any real, unless you're maybe Manchester City playing teams at home, there are no real gimmies, I think, for most teams. I mean, Tottenham-Brentford was a terrific game the other night, and Brentford are not having a good season. There's been a big drop-off there, but they were really, really good in the first half against Spurs. They got under Tottenham's skin, and Postecoglou made some proactive changes at half-time. They worked, and Spurs were 3-1 up within 15 minutes of the second half. There were so many engrossing games, and as I said, one of the reasons why United haven't outright dominated many games this season is because the quality in the league is really good. But I suppose the galling thing for United would be that if you were to look at Brighton, for example, who got tonked 4-0 by Luton the other night, their league season, it almost feels like it peaked against United in September, and it's been a while since we had a love letter written to Brighton about how great they are, because They've not been able to keep
right in those last season.
I know, yeah. And look, I think Brighton have been.
If I got you in the Secret Santa, I would have got you a Brighton shirt at Christmas.
There is an awful lot to admire about Brighton. That has not changed, but I do think De Zerbi's been far too erratic with his selection strategy. I mean, he's rotated goalkeepers. I don't think that's in Brighton's best interests, and he's almost been too clever for his own good. And look, United are above Brighton comfortably, and this is the thing with United in terms of the standards, how they're held to account compared to other clubs. I said to you 2 years ago, West Ham had their best season in decades, United had their worst season in decades, and United still finished above West Ham in the Premier League table. And I would still expect United to finish above.
That's why I made that famous West Ham this season.
It was ahead of the next, yeah, and I.
It was an easy money that.
It really was, and so yeah, I've probably digressed, but as you say, you mentioned Martinez and Casemiro, but Luke Shaw as well makes a really big difference to United's defence and also their attack. Like his contribution before the assist for Hoyland's goal last night, he was on the charge, and he's just a really good left back when he's fit and firing. And United need these players to be fit for the run in. And I've said already that this month they've got to aim for 12 to 15 points. I think if they end the month with between 12 to 15 points, then they're absolutely in with a shout of qualifying for the Champions League next season. Say they beat West Ham this weekend, and even if they get a draw maybe at Villa Park next week. I mean, Villa, it was the first home defeat all season to Newcastle midweek. It was there were a couple of results in the week where it was like they were like COVID results. They were just something out of nothing. And I think obviously Newcastle are a very good side, but I don't think many would have been betting on them being 3-0 up so quickly at Aston Villa. But if United have got, say, 7 points after their first three games this month, having played two teams above them in the Premier League table, that sets them up quite well for Luton away and then Fulham at home, which are their remaining league matches in February.
Could almost be a season-defining month in a way. It's a huge month.
I think so, yes.
And not just because it's my birthday this month, Samuel, as well. That's why it's a huge month. Yep. On the year team. So you got anything planned for us? You got us a nice gift?
Well, it's my birthday as well this month, Stephen. So we could indeed do an exchange.
Is it
there.
Your 50th this month?
No. I'm not going to dignify
that. For part two.
I'll get you a Sunderland shirt for that.
We'll leave it there for part two. We'll be back in a moment for part three. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester Is Red podcast. Now, Samuel, we should probably briefly mention that it was after the January transfer deadline day yesterday among the football.
Should we?
It was a very quiet window. I think we said at the start of the month, yeah, you sign. I think we said at the start of the month it was going to be a quiet January. The only departure really, Isaac Hansen-Aaron to Werder Bremen. There was a few flexi loans to non-league clubs, but we'll not give them a mention. But I think it's fair to say probably a lot of supporters.
There'll be one of our former colleagues would be very unhappy by that, given that Rochdale have taken two United players on loan. She'll be having words with you, I think, if she listens.
System. I mean, for fans who don't know, United developed this last year where academy players will spend their time between a club and obviously the academy itself, so they can still represent the under-21s and train around the first team while getting senior experience. So it's quite a good initiative, to be fair. I think it worked out last season. Joe Hugel went to Altrincham. Maxi Oyedele went out as well. They've now secured loans at Burton and Forest Green. So that just shows you that it prepares youngsters for later on in their careers. But would you like to say anything about Hansen-Aaron joining Werder Bremen, Samuel? I presume not.
Well, when that news was confirmed on the WhatsApp group that United informed journalists of news on, I was amazed by the first person to reply asking what the fee was. And I won't name them, but I said to Ty when this message dropped on the car on the way to Wolves, I said, there's no way he has heard of Isaac Hansen-Aaron. Then I messaged my learned colleague separately and I said, you've never heard of him, have you? And he replied saying, "That's the first time I've ever heard of him." So I think he ended up still writing a story on it just because there was absolutely nothing else to write about regarding United yesterday. And when we were in the press lounge at Wolves, they had Sky Sports News on the telly. Fortunately, the sound was muted. No offence to any of the presenters or reporters on there. But when we saw Melissa Reddy, who of course is at Carrington fairly often, playing darts with Jamie O'Hara in the reception, I think we knew that this was probably the nadir of deadline day coverage. I mean, of course, there was the infamous one outside Everton's training ground in 2014, which I'm sure if anyone just
Googles it, you can't compare that to flying objects behind reporters, can you? The good old days.
I don't think it was a flying object, though, was it? It was a.
Well, I was trying to be clever of my use of words there. It was
an instrument that was poked into a reporter's ear. But yeah, I think I'll leave it at that. But I was delighted that it was as dead as it was. I think transfers, by and large, are pretty tedious, and this just
clubs are still getting to grips with FFP, aren't they?
Yeah, the profitability and the sustainability rules have brought the spending right down. I think Simon Peach said yesterday, like the biggest fee that was agreed, for whatever reason, Juventus have signed Carlos Alcaraz from Southampton loan, and there's an option to buy him for 40-odd million pounds. I mean, I know he did well at Wimbledon last year, but I think for his value to go up that much is a bit much. Have you missed the reference there?
I completely missed that there. I was
Carlos Alcaraz won he has the same name as the guy who won. I think I might just gift you a picture of me with the League Cup trophy as your birthday present, the way it's going.
Just get some tickets to Wimbledon next year, because I know you went in the summer, didn't you? Who did you see play when you went?
I'm not a big fan of him, but I saw Djokovic on the first day. But yes, I mean, Wimbledon, I used to live in Wimbledon as well, so it's always wonderful to go back there. But moving back onto the transfer-related stuff at United, I think we're all quite delighted that the transfer window was as barren as it was. I messaged an agent yesterday saying, "Is this the deadest deadline day you've known it?" And he just replied, "Deadline." With the dead in block capitals. That was an opportunity
to use Simon Jordan's famous quote when he said it was deader than a dead thing from Deadland on Talk Sport once. He was talking about a takeover, which was a fantastic quote. Anyway, Samuel, West Ham on Sunday visiting Old Trafford. Obviously, United lost 2-0 in London before Christmas. That was a very disappointing performance. So they've got a bit of a point to prove here. I think West Ham, the style causes United some trouble. I think they can kind of absorb pressure and are really efficient on their counter-attack. And Bruno Fernandes actually discussed that yesterday after the win. So again, not a really straightforward game. I mean, there never is in the Premier League, which is a cliche. But West Ham are 6 and 1 point above United. So it will be tough.
It's a really big game, as you said, just because West Ham are above United. And if United win, they go above West Ham, and that's got to be the aim this month, that they climb up the table and they end the month in a much higher position than they started it. Had Chelsea won this week and Wolves won last night, United would have actually fallen into the bottom half of the table, which, I mean, when was the last time that happened? In February? Maybe not before my lifetime. I'm that old, but it probably would have been late 80s, some of the early years of Ferguson. But West Ham obviously did United a favour last night in that they dropped points at home to Bournemouth. They're a very good team. And Kudus is back, of course. They've got Calvin Phillips in from Manchester City, so I imagine he'll start. I think when you look at West Ham's defence, and Rich and I said this before the game at the London Stadium just before Christmas, that it's a really gettable defence. It's not particularly impressive. There are a lot of chinks in their armour there. But they have assembled a really good front six, and they've got, it's not just six players they're dependent on either. Ward-Prowse, Suchek and Phillips, that's three in midfield. Edson Alvarez is another midfielder who's come in. It feels like that they've done a better job, or they've got a better hit rate of signing players from Ajax than United have, given that Alvarez is has been decent. Kudus has been a terrific signing, and that was a very easy angle to go at in the reverse fixture, given how well he did and how badly Anthony was doing at United and is still doing. And Jared Bowen's come up with goals this season with his kind of little reinvention as a false nine. That's worked out really well. It's innovative thinking from David Moyes. And he's just come off the back of his best year in management, having won a trophy with West Ham, winning their Europa League group. I think they ended the calendar year winning 2-0 at Arsenal as well. They're having a good season. It has been undermined by going out of the FA Cup as early as they have done, but they've, as I said, they're already in the last 16 of the Europa League, and I think they'll be staking a lot on that. They've got a good pedigree with it as well, having been the Conference League final last year. The season before that, they got to the semi-finals of the Europa League. So they have got the know-how and the experience to go deep into that competition. And I suspect that will be what defines their season, because let's face it, they're not going to finish in the top four. I think they'll do exceptionally well to do that, but they'll probably fall away at some point. And I'd still be very confident of United finishing above them this season. But it is a big game. United, I would imagine Ten Hag will go with what he regards and most people would regard as his strongest team. But
the team picks itself, doesn't it? I wasn't even going to bother asking about that.
It does.
I think we're all going to pick the same starting next night for the game.
Well, I haven't though. To quote Roy Keane, I'm sick to death of this goalkeeper.
You did mention him in the first part, and we haven't actually discussed him. So feel free, Samuel. I mean, he was very unconvincing against Wolves. He came up with that ball and it was almost reminiscent of the reverse fixture at Old Trafford in August when we were both there. He clattered him, didn't he, again? It could have been a penalty.
Yeah, I think the one last night, it wasn't a full-on clattering that the one in August was. I agreed with the decision not to give a penalty last night, but he was let off the hook by a brilliant piece of intervention by Martinez. And then he's unconvincing for the second goal. And with the third goal, it's my near post. Have a go there, just hit it there, and I'm going to stand like a statue. I'm losing patience with him. I just put Bayinder in goal, and I know Bayinder is not going to go in goal, but Onana, of course, you know, he embarks on the celebratory sprint to join in at the end with Manu's goal, and of course, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. He's done that before this season, and he's invested in United. He's delighted when they win, of course he is, but I think he's probably so delighted they've won some of these games, and it reminds me of Brentford, his celebration last night. And of course what happened in the Brentford game was that he let a savable shot in that game, and he's just conceding far too many goals where you look at it and think the goalkeeper can save that. It's not unsavable. And yeah, it feels like I've got an agenda against ex-Ajax players on this on today's edition, given that Anthony's taken has been whipped already and now it's Onana's turn. But you've got to exert a bit more pressure on him. And none of the goals that he conceded last night were an outright clanger, not at all. But when that third goal went in, one, I was taken aback by how easily Varane was done, and I'm sure there was an element of fatigue that set in for him, given that he's a pretty brittle player and he played for pushing 100 minutes last night. But if you're that side, you just think, I've got to cover my near post because this is where he's nearest to, and also just use your initiative. When a player's going to cut inside, there's a chance that they will just have a shot and it could go towards the near post rather than the far post. So suffice to say, he's not having a good season.
Anyone mention at all? Was he actually started last season on the bench for Inter Milan? First 8 games, he was on the bench.
Oh, because of
the team and played well.
Was it Handanovic? Yeah, I mean, was still
he was obviously
there.
Excellent. He was obviously excellent in the Champions League in the latter part of the campaign, and he conceded the fewest goals in that competition in the end. But he wasn't number one for the whole season. Obviously, he was by the end of it. He's just had a very unconvincing first 8 months, hasn't he? Unfortunately. There's been far too many mistakes. And he's another player who needs a strong end to the season. Otherwise, we'll go into next year and we'll be question marks. So, being there for you, Samuel? He was unconvincing as well against Newport, wasn't he?
He was inoffensive. He was neither neither really good, neither really bad. I mean, the goals weren't, he wasn't to blame for the goals at Newport. There were some kinks to iron out in his game. He's clearly not going to be a number one at United. I mean, he has literally got the number one on the back of his shirt, but nobody's pretending that he's going to be a long-term first choice.
You don't trust a goalkeeper who wears leggings, and he wore leggings.
I did mention that's a red flag. And it was not that cold at Newport either. I didn't even have my typing gloves on. It was that mild. So yeah, he didn't need that. But they've signed these two goalkeepers in one summer. So I don't think this summer is going to be a transfer window where they need to be prioritising a goalkeeper necessarily. I think they've got to try and make the most of what they've got and knock both of them into shape.
You have Tom Heaton a lifetime contract. That's the answer.
I wouldn't be against Heaton being in goal. I thought he did pretty well in pre-season.
He performed really well in pre-season. And he's competent with the ball at his feet as well, actually. He looked really sharp.
He's never let United down. Across his three games.
He's hardly ever played.
Yes.
Yeah. A quick mention to check out Samuel's newsletter. You can sign up for that on our site. We'll also have details and a bit of information on how to go about that in the YouTube video below the site. Samuel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate it.
And thanks to listeners as usual. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday afternoon to review United's game against West Ham. Take care.